listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I received a call today from the President of the United States at a little after noontime from Air Force One.
Thus began a press conference called hastily early Tuesday afternoon by now outgoing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
And I've also spoken to White House Chief of Staff Kelly to ensure we have clarity as to the days ahead. What is most important is to ensure an orderly and smooth transition during a time that the country continues to face significant policy and national security challenges.
Tillerson said he would be leaving the job formally at the end of the month, and functionally at the close of business on Tuesday.
Effective at the end of the day, I'm delegating all responsibilities of the Office of the Secretary to Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. My commission as Secretary of State will terminate at midnight, March the 31st.
The new Acting Secretary of State, John J. Sullivan, was confirmed as a deputy by the U.S. Senate on May 24th of last year. Prior to assuming office, he was a partner in Mayer Brown LLP, co-chair of that firm's national security practice. From 2010 to 2016, he was the chair of the U.S.-Iraq Business Dialogue, a governmental advisory committee on U.S. economic relations with Iraq. He served in two administrations in senior positions at the Justice, Defense, and Commerce Departments.
Between now and then, I will address a few administrative matters related to my departure and work towards a smooth and orderly transition for Secretary of State Designate Mike Pompeo.
Also on Tuesday, it was announced that CIA Director Mike Pompeo would replace Tillerson and that Pompeo would himself be replaced in turn as head of CIA by Deputy Director Gina Haspel. We'll have more on all of that in our next newscast. Tillerson pointed out that there were many foreign policy challenges facing the United States at this time. One of those has the U.S. and Russia squaring off dangerously, that's in Syria. On Monday, Syria was again the subject of discussion at the UN Security Council. This was Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia, Russia's permanent representative to the United Nations, responding to comments made by the U.S.'s permanent representative Nikki Haley at Monday's council session.
Thank you, Mr. President. Last time I promised that I would count how many times the permanent representative would mention in her next statement Russia, and the name of Russia. And I counted this today, and it's 22 times. France followed that. They mentioned Russia 16 times. And the third place is occupied by the UK 12 times. Of course, it's not just the mentioning of the country that is important, but also the context in which this was done. The fact that this is being done, this is a political line, and this is caused not only and not so much by the concern about the humanitarian needs of the Syrians. We think it's important for everyone to understand that the Resolution 2401 is not talking about an immediate ceasefire. That would have been utopian. What it's talking about is a preliminary agreement amongst parties as a precondition for sustained de-escalation in all difficult areas of Syria, not only Eastern Ghouta. This is the only realistic way forward. And the resolution contained unequivocal requirements in that regard. And we are trying to facilitate that. And you have heard about that today and will hear about this today. The authorities in Damascus expressed their content with the contents of the resolution and the readiness to implement. At the same time, very rightly, they ask for an immediate cessation of attacks on the capital and all attempts to undermine the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of the country. The counter-terrorist operation, which is continued by the Syrian military, is not in contradiction with Resolution 2401. The government of Syria has every right to try and remove the threat to the safety of its citizens. The suburbs of Damascus cannot remain a hotbed of terrorism. And it is the continued attempts of terrorism to undermine the cessation of hostilities regime that is the reason why the highly tense situation in Syria continues. And of course, the most difficult area in this regard is Eastern Ghouta. The Cairo agreements of 2017 about de-escalation in Eastern Ghouta provided the fighters with an opportunity to become involved in political settlement. They did not take this opportunity, and they still have not separated themselves from terrorists, because what is being done by the groups is being coordinated from a single headquarters, which is being led by Jabhat al-Nusra. We know for a fact that they have an active radio exchange and they discuss inter alia their plans for shelling the humanitarian corridors. Why is it that it's just only now that they have started talking about their readiness to expel al-Nusra from Eastern Ghouta? And why are we the only ones to ask that question? We have answered the question ourselves, saying that we have suspicions that Nusra is being kept specifically for very special political purposes. And in this case, in order to maintain a dangerous hotbed of resistance very close to the Syrian capital. But we are continuously being told tales about how very few terrorism there supposedly are in Eastern Ghouta. So who is going to verify the implementation of the resolution by armed groups? Who will be held responsible for this? Please don't tell us that the regime is responsible for everything, as well as the regime in inverted commas, as well as Russia and Iran. Such ideological statements are not serious within the course of the professional discussion we're having here in the Security Council. How are you going to be held responsible for the implementation of 2401? How are you doing that? What responsibility do you carry for supporting the fighters that you're extending support to? In the wake of Resolution 2401, with the participation of Russia, we established daily 5-hour humanitarian pauses, opened the checkpoint of Mukhayam al-Fidin for the peaceful citizens and the fighters with their families. They were guaranteed safety. They were given transport throughout the whole route. After that, Syrian authorities opened another checkpoint, Mleha Jisrain, in the southern part of Eastern Ghouta. This had medical positions, hot food distribution points, and buses are standing by. But fighters continued shelling the central areas of Damascus and the suburbs in a massive way. They release tens of mines in a day, and this leads to deaths and wounded people and many, many, many destructions. Since resolution was passed, the more than 100 people died from this, and a considerably higher number were wounded. More than once, hospitals Tishrina and Biruni were shelled, as well as a medical center in Arrihan. These are true hospitals, genuine hospitals, not headquarters of fighters who very frequently they claim are hospitals. Snipers are being actively used, and we know all of this for a fact. The death of any number of civilians in an armed conflict is a tragedy. But our delegation has always been interested in the origin of the statistical data that's being used with the United Nations. Given how politicized the subject is, it's very important. In Eastern Ghouta, very frequently we hear assessments of the losses among the civilians. We expect that in future reports, what we will see is the source of this data, how reliable it is, and who exactly is meant by the trustworthy sources on the ground. All of the past days, the extremists forbade peaceful citizens to leave the areas that they are besieging and stopped any attempt to resist them, this up to and including demonstration executions. This is also something that we know for a fact. They're constantly striking on corridors and checkpoints, including during the humanitarian pauses. On the 9th of March, they shelled a refugees column, and once again they undermined this evacuation process. They intensified the use of tunnels in order to provoke the Syrian military. And the exits of the tunnels are in the area of public buildings, first and foremost, mosques, hospitals, and markets. They increased prices on foodstuffs, and at the same time, they requisitioned food, water, medicine, and mobile telephones from the people. They create sources for fire in buildings, and they use people as human shields. They mine the areas which are right next to the line of contact. They carry out searches, and they remove the brochures, passes, which are distributed by the government. And those who try to resist those repressions people are trying to resist this. They organize protests, and they become involved in clashes. On the 1st of March, the terrorists executed 11 participants of such a protest. Today, there was a major protest in Kaprubach. The first meeting, the exit of what took place on 9th of March, where together with Russian officers, 52 people left the area, 26 of them are children. Some of the fighters also want to leave the area, but the field commanders threaten them with execution. On the 9th of March, as a result of long and painstaking negotiations with the participation of officers from the Russian Center of Reconciliation, for the first time from the enclave through the humanitarian corridors, upon their request, 13 fighters were taken out. Jaish al-Islam is something that we negotiate with in order to have an agreement on the second set of fighters to leave that area. We also had a meeting with the leaders of Velak al-Rahman, where they were given a demand to immediately separate themselves from Jamhat al-Musra. But according to the information we have, the fighters from that group decided to continue their armed struggle by forced recruiting men from the peaceful population to their ranks. A couple of words about organizing the humanitarian convoy into Douma on the 1st of March. The government of Syria and the Russian military carried out a comprehensive support for this. We provided a humanitarian corridor, ensured the safety going through that. We monitored the situation. At the same time, what we witnessed is numerous examples of disorganized activity by humanitarians. According to our information, the UN staff extended and delayed this action and created real security risks. At the time when the convoy was being put together, they tried to place undeclared medical supplies into it. And they spent about 2 hours on a meeting with the leaders of the so-called local councils. They disseminated unreliable information about aerial strikes in the area or offloading, and this information was very happily taken up by some delegations here today. Even though what happened was one shelling strike from the position of an armed grab, they also were completely unresponsive to the request of peaceful civilians to leave the enclaves. Nonetheless, 13 people, out of them 5 children, were taken out. It was curious for me to then read one of the field commanders from Harar al-Sham, who expressed with irony his gratitude for the humanitarian pause on the day, which allows the fighters to regroup and prepare traps for the Syrian military. The 9th of March activity was carried out successfully with the assistance of the Russian military. Nonetheless, in the eastern Ghouta is not the only area to which 2401 applies. In the past 2 weeks, Nusra and other armed groups also shelled the Hama province on many than one occasion. Their victims because of the shelling of Hura Kafra and Idlib. And clashes between the groups there led to the threat of a certain number of medical facilities being closed. What we also notice is that Nusra has become more active in the southern areas of de-escalation, which could have to do with the fact that they're being supplied weapons from the outside. April is a very difficult situation there. The Syrian authorities gave the permission to provide assistance to the Rugban camp on the territory, which is illegally held by the Americans surrounding a military base. And we'd like to find out what the UN is doing on that. Our thinking is that the humanitarian assistance is something that will be done by a respected entity such as the International Committee on Red Cross and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. We expect also that the UN mission on the humanitarian assistance into Raqqa, bombed by the coalition, will be sent as quickly as possible, without delay. And the question to the UN is this, as follows: when will this mission take place? We understand very well the rationale behind the disinformation campaign. The goal here is to create the public assistance on the use of the Syrian authorities of toxic substances. In the meantime, we and the Syrian party have our fears that what is being prepared is a provocation in order to then blame the Syrian authorities that they're carrying out chemical attacks. According to the data we have, al-Nusra used chlorine in eastern Ghouta on the 5th of March. 30 people suffered from that. All of this is being done in order to prepare the ground for the unilateral use of force against sovereign Syria, and we have heard hints of that in the statements of some delegations today. Basically, steps are being weighed which could hit regional stability very, very hard. And at the same time, we know that the territories that used to be under the armed groups have chemical warehouses, but the UN specialized UN entities do react to the complaints about this by Syrian authorities very slowly. We will continue our efforts to carry out implement 2401, but we request that some of our colleagues travel their own part of the road and exert genuine pressure on the groups that they sponsor or support. They keep calling on Russia, creating false impression that this resolution is only to us. And in conclusion, Mr. President, let me say that today, in the second half of the day, 4 members of the Security Council are holding an informal ARIA meeting with the goal of making sure that the opposition voices are heard and the media will be present in numbers, it is planned. We would like to first and foremost point out that it is unacceptable to use the UN resources for politicized goals. ARIA formula meetings were created for something which is completely different. What is behind this is a desire of organizers to exert pressure on the Syrian governments and those who help them fight terrorism. In our view, in order to have a full picture, what we need to do is listen to the peoples of Raqqa and those who are in Rukban camp. And also in Eastern Ghouta, we can find very numerous people who would be happy to launch an appeal to save them from the presence of extremists. Thank you.
The last speaker to be heard at Monday's Security Council session about Syria was Syria's permanent representative, Ambassador Bashar al-Ja'afari.
Shukran.
Thank you. I welcome the Secretary General, and I would like to allude to what he mentioned at the outset of his briefing, that the General Secretariat does not have all the information necessary to accurately analyze and evaluate the situation in Syria due to the fact that the UN is not present all over and throughout Syria. This is exactly what was said by the General Secretariat with polite humbleness, as they mentioned that they are not privy to all the information relevant to the Syrian situation, notwithstanding the fact that the UN has an OCHA office in Damascus and there are dozens of UN agencies operating in Syria. In addition to 13 international non-governmental organizations also operating in Syria. However, some of our colleagues in this Security Council who have shut down their embassies in Damascus now are totally disconnected from credible information, and they found a trove in information of what is known as open resources. Thus, they provided us with myriad of information that would never serve the interest of the Syrian people or your interest in such important and significant discussion, because this disinformation might poison the atmosphere and feud sedition regarding the role of the Security Council, which is mandated to maintain international peace and security. Mr. President, the Syrian government stands ready to seriously engage with positive international initiatives which serve the interests of the Syrian people, especially ending the bloodletting throughout Syria. Throughout Syria, I'm here quoting the Resolution 2401. My country expressed its satisfaction with Resolution 2401, especially the positive directions contained therein. And in this regard, we do confirm that we have taken all the following procedures to deliver our people in Eastern Ghouta from their suffering. First, immediately after the adoption of Resolution 2401, hostilities were ceased on a daily basis. And until this very moment, from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. Damascus local time, with the aim to deliver humanitarian aid and to ensure unimpeded and safe exit of civilians from the areas controlled by terrorist groups. Secondly, two safe humanitarian corridors are open for civilians wishing to exit the enclave. Third, two joint United Nations ICRC convoys in collaboration with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent have been sent to Eastern Ghouta on the 5th and 9th of March. Notwithstanding the foregoing, all these procedures have always been countered by the armed organizations present in the enclave, which continued, incited by their paymasters, and some of them, unfortunately, are members to the Security Council. They were targeting the civilians in Damascus starting 2018, as they fired more than 2,499 missiles and mortar, which claimed the lives of 70 civilians and injured 556 people. These organizations denied our people in Eastern Ghouta exit in order to continue to use them as human shields and a material for humanitarian and media blackmail. They even targeted those who managed to escape towards the two corridors by firing bullets and missiles. And the latest incident was on 8th of March, when what is known as Failaq al-Rahman, which is a terrorist arm of the petty state of Qatar in Syria, targeted a convoy for civilians, which was driving towards one of the corridors, a matter that led to high casualties among civilians. And by the way, That terrorist organization, Failaq al-Rahman, was hailed by some of you because of its readiness to implement Resolution 2401. It was rather presented as moderate Syrian opposition. And there was a letter that was signed by that organization with other terrorist organizations to the Secretary General, is propagated also by some of the members to the Security Council. And this is the modus operandi of the Security Council with terrorist groups. Mr. President, the procedures taken by the Syrian government are not limited to Eastern Ghouta, because during the last days we undertook inter alia a number of procedures. First of all, we requested the United Nations and a number of humanitarian organizations to immediately send a mission to investigate the humanitarian situation in Raqqa, which was destroyed by the international coalition led by the U.S. Secondly, to approve the operation of humanitarian convoys to Rukban camp, provided that this aid is to be delivered and distributed by the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and the Red Cross exclusively and not by the authorities of the U.S. occupation or forces or the terrorist groups in Rukban. Third, 2 days ago, the SARC managed to obtain the governmental approvals to send convoys to Ghouta, Rekha, Afrin, and Rukban. Until this very date, they did not manage to send the convoy to Rukban and Afrin, as the United Nations failed to ensure the necessary safeguards by the U.S. and Turkish occupation forces. This is the main reason. Ladies and gentlemen, with every feat and advance by the Syrian army against terrorist groups in any given area, the country sponsoring terrorism are very fast to launch heated disinformation campaign to distract the world from the aggression, terrorism, and occupation against Syria. This confirms that these countries have never been keen on the lives of citizens and civilians, but they were nonetheless keen on protecting their investment in terrorism, as was said by the ex-Prime Minister of Qatar. This in order to recycle the terrorism in other parts of Syria. This behavior that I have alluded to is not limited to states sponsoring terrorism. Unfortunately, it is even demonstrated by some of the senior officials of the General Secretariat. We hoped that the Secretary General, especially in light of the second preambular paragraph of Resolution 2401, we hoped that it would have provided an unequivocal legal qualification of the crimes committed by the so-called international coalition led by the United States against our people in Syria, and the procedures ensuring ending this aggression. We also hoped that the Secretary General would provide us with unequivocal legal qualification of the acts of the invading Turkish forces to a very dear part of our territory, especially against our people in Afrin, and the procedures ensuring ending this Turkish aggression, as well as an unequivocal and clear legal description of the presence of the U.S. forces on the Syrian territories without the approval of the Syrian government, and the procedures ensuring ending this occupation. Mr. President, the Arab Republic of Syria reaffirms its right to defend its citizens and fighting terrorism according to the relevant Security Council resolutions, especially the second operative paragraph of Resolution 2401, and to fight all those who practice, fund, and support terrorism, and to work towards the restoration of peace, stability, and security, and to rebuild all that was damaged and destroyed by terrorism. Finally, I have listened to the U.S. representative, who is again and again leveling charges against my country, and that its country will undertake procedures against my country, notwithstanding the international legitimacy, exactly as they have done when they bombarded Al-Shu'airat air base in my country last year. All these irresponsible and provocative statements and declarations, and which run counter to the UN Charter, is very direct incitement to the terrorist groups to use the chemical weapons and to fabricate again all the evidence and proofs, as they have done previously, to accuse the Syrian army. I would like to remind the representative of the United States that the JIM has refused and denied taking any samples from Al-Shu'ayrat Air Base, because if it had done that, it would have categorically proved that the Syrian government is totally irresponsible and should not be held accountable to what has happened in Ain Shaykhun. And actually, what happened from the U.S. party is aggression. I do call upon the representatives of the U.S., U.K., and France to put an end to their violation of the Security Council resolutions related to fighting terrorism, and that their governments should stop sponsoring the terrorist groups in my country and to stop providing them with a political umbrella to continue their crimes against the Syrian people. It's high time, Mr. Chair, that the U.S. administration took lessons from its mistakes and to put an end to these mistakes. Isn't it enough what they have done in Vietnam, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, invoking very cheap lies that have been already condemned by the international public opinion? And in this regard, I do remember Najib Mahfouz, something that was said by Najib Mahfouz, the Nobel laureate. And I quote, they are liars. They know they are liars. And they know that we know that they are liars. However, they still lie, and very loudly so. Mr. President, in conclusion, the Russian Center for Reconciliation in Syria said that street war has started in Ghouta after requests of dissent by Failak Rahman from Al-Nusra Front. The current and these wars that are taking place right now impede the exit by civilians, and thus they are forced to find safe haven under the ground. Thank you, Mr. President.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It appears, and highly likely, these are the words used by UK Prime Minister Theresa May, pinning blame on Russia for the poison attack on a former Russian intelligence officer turned British spy. Claims are made and threats flaunted, of course, without evidence. Cross-talking the poison attack in Britain, I'm joined by my guest, Alexander Mercuris, in London. He is a writer on legal affairs as well as editor-in-chief of TheDuran.com. Also in London, we have Charles Shoebridge. He is a security analyst and a former UK Army and counterterrorism intelligence officer. And in Brussels, we cross to Annie Machone. She is a former British intelligence officer and writer. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Alexander Mercuris, I'd like to go to you an article that you just recently wrote. And the title is very telling. Theresa May now demands Russia prove itself innocence. And that's a very curious form of jurisprudence, isn't it? Isn't it backwards what she's asking? Go ahead.
Well, that is exactly what she's asking, because she's asking that by a certain specified time, Russia is supposed to say that, provide the evidence that will prove that it was not the Russian state that did this thing. Now, that completely reverses the burden of proof, which is that somebody is assumed to be innocent until they're proved guilty, and it is the person who makes the accusation who is supposed to prove it. And this is a complete reversal of a principle that has underpinned the whole direction of European jurisprudence since the Middle Ages. But that's the kind of situation which we are in.
Okay, Annie, it seems to me, but with the prime minister's words, that she's already foregone an investigation because she already has a culprit. I mean, again, it seems everything's upside down. And by doing this, like we had in the Litvinenko case, where you've already decided the guilty party and you won't go down different avenues to do actually real investigation and find out what happened. This is a repeat. That's the only thing that's similar with the Litvinenko case before, is it's been politicized instead of going through the nuts and bolts of doing detective work. Go ahead, Annie.
Absolutely. And we saw this when the story broke last week, in the sense that the British media stampeded down this path. But I have to give certain credit to the Home Secretary of the UK, Amber Rudd, because she did say for many days, we need to allow the police space to investigate this and identify the substance. Now, in terms of investigation, I would suggest there are three avenues they had to go down. First of all, the boots on the street, getting eyewitness accounts, CCTV footage, that sort of thing. Secondly, identifying the substance, which they now say they have done. But thirdly and crucially, finding out what this guy has been up to over the last 8 years, since he was rinsed clean by the Russian service before he was sent over, pardoned and sent back to the UK, and would have been rinsed clean of intelligence by MI6 once he arrived in the UK. So I can't see a motive there. But in terms of the substance as well, if this nerve agent is what they say it is, it might have been developed in Russia 30 years ago. But then, you know, plenty of nerve agents have been developed by plenty of other countries as well, including the US, Germany, the UK. So in this case, to say it was developed by Russia 30 years ago means that it must have been the Russians that did it. It's a bit like saying, well, Porton Down, the UK scientific establishment, secretly developed something called VX, another nerve agent, in the 1950s. And that was used to assassinate Kim Jong-un's brother, the North Korean leader, last year. So, you know, the equivalent would be to say, well, Britain developed this poison, therefore Britain must have assassinated this guy. It's crazy. But there seems to be very little critical analysis going on in the stampede to blame Russia.
Well, they don't want any critical analysis. Let me go to Charles here. I mean, it seems like the entire political establishment and the media in the UK are very happy with the words that it's Russia's fault, and that's, and now we have to wait for the consequences here. I mean, there's like ultimatums on both sides now. The Russians want to say, well, what is this stuff? Show it to us. Maybe we can help you identify it. And then the ultimatum is that you have to admit your guilt on the British side here. I mean, the British side doesn't want any kind of resolution here. They have already got what they wanted. They have a narrative that, you know, Russia's bad and we have to sanction it somehow in some form. And maybe we can mention the World Cup here in a second here. Go ahead, Charles.
Yes, undoubtedly, you can see from the comments of some politicians, but especially that of the mainstream media here in the UK and to a lesser extent elsewhere, that there is an agenda driving this, irrespective of what the facts that lay behind this incident are. I mean, Annie quite rightly recognised, and remember, I speak as a former detective and an investigator in matters similar to this in some ways, that motive is an important part of that. It isn't everything. But the and then the other evidence to see which way it points. The evidence of the actual physical evidence here, such as been disclosed, because a great amount of it, of course, hasn't been disclosed and perhaps hasn't yet been even discovered, isn't in any way conclusive in this case. But when it comes to motive, arguably there is a motive for Russia to kill somebody that or to attempt to kill somebody who is seen as a traitor. But in this particular case, there is a much greater motive, surely, to avoid this kind of situation. Just weeks before Russian elections, just before the World Cup, at a time when there is enough stress and problems between the West and the East as it currently stands, why Russia would carry out this kind of attack, particularly, it would appear, using a method that anybody that used that method would surely know would point straight back to Russia. So we can say here, I think, somewhat conclusively, at least at this stage, that whatever the circumstances of the attack, whoever carried it out, if they did use this nerve agent that's been described, did it knowing that Russia would almost certainly be blamed. And then you therefore you have to ask the question, would that be Russia?
Yeah, you know, Alexander, again, I'm glad that Charles brought that up. I mean, why in the world, just like in the case of Litvinenko, you know, use a means to try to kill someone that is so extraordinary that, you know, the possibilities of who could have done it is very much narrowed, as Charles pointed out. This seems, I'm sorry, for me, it looks like a complete setup, okay? And the timing is perfect for people that want to push the narrative of worse relations between Russia and the West. One more other thing, Charles, the whole situation going on in the Ukraine, where it's just grossly unreported in the Western media. Go ahead, Alexander.
Yes, I mean, there is very wide speculation, not perhaps in the mainstream media, but elsewhere, that this is a kind of provocation, some sort of a provocation intended to worsen relations even further between Russia and the West, and to complicate the situation in advance of the World Cup and the Russian presidential elections. I personally am going to resist the temptation to speculate along these lines, simply because we just don't know enough about this incident. Mm-hmm. And I want to just also repeat a point that Charles Shoebridge made, which I think is an entirely valid one. I have not been an investigator, but in my past life, I have seen the results of many investigations. And very often, in fact, more often than not, the clue to a person's death is or attack is in the person themselves, in their background. And we need to know an awful lot more about this person and why he was attacked and why he was chosen as an attack. And to start pointing fingers at this very early stage is frankly completely wrong. I would make one final point at this in response to all of this, which is, of course, when ultimatums are made, such as the one that Theresa May has made, it is, to my mind, a sign that the British government doesn't have the evidence that points to Russia. Because if it did, why would it challenge the Russians to prove their innocence in that kind of way?
You know, Annie, one of the things that's really interesting in this, you know, Skripal, he was part of this prisoner exchange, spy exchange in 2010. Presumably, they could have pretty much squeezed everything out of him, the FSB and British intelligence. I mean, he kind of went to the UK as a blank sheet, I would imagine here. What could you speculate, since it's kind of was your world at one time? I mean, what in the world did he, after going through all that, being in a Russian prison for espionage for the British government, I mean, what in the world could he possibly gotten himself into that would warrant this kind of, a murder attempt? Go ahead, Annie. I mean, because I'm mystified.
This is absolutely the key question in my view. So we have a guy who was recruited and betrayed his country for 10 years. He worked as an agent for MI6, and he handed over other agent names across Europe, reportedly. And then he was caught, he was tried, he was convicted, he was imprisoned. And then he was pardoned by the Russian state and allowed to go to the UK as part of the 2010 spy swap with the Russian alleged illegals, which included Anna Chapman, who went back to Russia. So, of course, Russia would have known exactly what he knew. They would have put him through the mill in terms of getting any intelligence out of him. And they would not have released him if they thought he was still a threat.
Yeah.
Then, of course, when he arrived in the UK, he would have been debriefed for weeks by MI6 before allowed to go free and live a life. And, you know, he lived his life quite openly. So this is the key question, and I've been saying this ever since the story broke. What on earth was he involved in the last 8 years since he's been living in the UK? You know, who was he working with? Who were his contacts? And that might give the investigators a clue to who might indeed have perpetrated this attack. I don't think it's going to be a Russian state retaliatory thing. I just cannot see the motivation.
Well, I don't either. You know, Charles, I mean, I mean, there's some speculation. There's so many people that have their own theories. I think there's a page on the RT website, all the different conspiracies out there. Some people are making a connection to Jonathan's Christopher Steele. I mean, does that make any sense to you?
No, it doesn't. First of all, of course, this person was long out of, indeed, of course, arguably so was Christopher Steele, was long out of any, shall we say, orbit of knowledge of what's going on in the Russian military or security establishment. He wasn't really in a position to be able to provide any of this kind of information. And also, I think I've read elsewhere, it may be true, maybe not true, that Steele himself, certainly in talking to, I think, to The Guardian, which has had a lot of contact pushing the Steele dossier, for example, that actually he wasn't involved in any way in the production of that dossier.
I'm going to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on British-Russian relations. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
You know, Alexander, one of the peculiar things about the UK since the end of the Soviet Union is that a lot of ethnic Russians, many of them with very dubious pasts and ways they've made their money, have found their way into the UK. When it's convenient, they say they're a political dissident. I always like that little trick here, with their pockets all stuffed full of money. But it's kind of turned into a kind of morbid playground of settling scores that have, you know, have some kind of connection with Russia. In the case that we're talking about right now, that it looks like it was a purely British affair. I mean, you know, isn't there any kind of reflection in the UK? Is that maybe you shouldn't let these crooked billionaires into the UK? I know they got a lot of money, and money does talk. Go ahead, Alexander.
What is so strange about this is, yes, there is some reflection about this. There are people who are saying, we've allowed all sorts of very dubious people from Russia to arrive here. But in an odd kind of twist, the blame for that is actually being directed at Russia. It's been spoken of as if these very strange people that you're talking about are somehow connected to the Russian authorities, whereas, as you and Peter and I, we both know, they're not. Most of these people are antagonistic to the Russian authorities. And, of course, they have their own quarrels. And that's why they've come to London, to get out of the reach of the Russian authorities. And they're bringing their problems to Britain. And we see the results. So if the British really do take action to stop these people coming to Britain, it's not going to anger or offend the Russians. The Russians will be pleased about it.
Sure.
This is, again, part of the upside-down world that we were talking about before.
You know, Annie, what does the Theresa May's government want? I mean, they obviously, if Russia hasn't given any kind of evidence about this case, forensic evidence, I mean, what in the world do they expect the Russians to do? And what do you think the sanction will be afterwards? Because, you know, Theresa May's she's in a political mess right now. She doesn't have a memorable time in office here. She's found this one issue. She's really pushing it here. I mean, coming to conclusions before facts are presented, none of it to the public, by the way, here. I mean, you know, what is this an internal domestic issue for her? I mean, she's found this one issue to kind of boost her a little bit because she needs a whole lot of boosting. Go ahead, Annie.
Well, I think, as you say, she's in a very weak political position. And she will be under pressure from MI6 because, bear in mind, this guy worked as an agent for MI6 for a decade and was handed back to them. They had a duty of protection to their source, and they seem to have fumbled it and allowed him to be attacked in the UK by persons unknown. But again, in terms of the political aspects and also the scientific aspects, we need to get the forensics around the chemicals that were used or allegedly used. So just to make statements in Parliament, which are quite bellicose, is reckless at this point. And she did say, well, it could have been the Russian state, or it could have been they didn't take enough care of securing their nerve agents, so it's their fault anyway. But bear in mind, there are other cases from history that other countries have done the same thing. So, for example, go back to 2001. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was a number of cases of militarized anthrax being sent through the post to politicians and news editors across the UK. 5 people died, 17 people were injured. And everyone was saying, oh, you know, it must be an outside source. It turned out after years of investigation, it was some rogue agent, allegedly, coming out of the laboratory itself. So, you know, even the USA can't secure it. It's biological and weapons mass destruction. So immediately say it must be the Russian state because they developed this 30 years ago, even though lots of other people have the recipe, they must have been slack in protecting it, I think is disingenuous at best and potentially hugely damaging for diplomatic relationships and world peace at worst.
Yeah, Charles, you know, I was made aware that I think it was in 1992, a lot of these chemical agents, they were revealed to the public. So how do certainly you need the facilities to make it, but the recipe, the roadmap is there, what it's all about, what kind of compounds and all that. So that kind of adds to the wrinkle here. But, Charles, what do you think that, you know, what does Theresa May really want? I mean, does she want to ratchet up this confrontation with Russia? And to what degree? I mean, there are so many fronts now where there is tension. And, so, you know, it's one of these games of chicken. And I can tell you, and I make it very clear to our viewers here, the Russian state's not going to blink. Just get used to it. There's plenty of cases we can say that around the world. Go ahead, Charles.
Yes, one wonders the extent to which in so many matters, in fact, and this is a good example of it, the extent to which Theresa May and even her government ministers are actually driving this situation, or whether they're being driven by it.
Yep.
And if they're being driven by it, they're being driven by other actors behind the scenes, perhaps even those that may have been involved in some degree and who could benefit from it, unlike Russia, which doesn't seem to be getting any benefit from this action whatsoever. We raised the subject of oligarchs, not just from Russia, from Ukraine and elsewhere in the world,
sure.
Unsavory in many cases in London. We asked the question, why are they allowed to settle here? One needs to look in some detail at the donations to political parties in this country, in the United Kingdom. Labour, for example, the opposition party has recently challenged the government to stop taking donations from Russian exile oligarchs in terms of political donations to the Conservative Party. That's been declined. So these people wield political power that is well beyond their, shall we say, representative basis. Mm-hmm. And so that may be a reason why they're untouchable here. But let's look at this Novichok, that this alleged chemical agent that's been used. I've just read very recently a 1999 article in the New York Times, no less, not a pro-Russian organ whatsoever, describing in 1999 the United States efforts to help clear up the production plant or testing plants involving, allegedly, this chemical agent Novichok. This is in 1999.
Yep.
It's not in Russia. It's in Uzbekistan. And so we can see that this agent is likely to be not just produced by Russia, but elsewhere as well. And furthermore, of course, it seems to be that certainly the consensus amongst many of the actual chemists, not the so-called experts from organizations such as Bellingcat and others that are then wheeled out by the media in these circumstances because they know their coverage will be pro-US, UK in every instance. But real chemists are saying the one consensus seems to be that even if it's not particularly easy to make, the ingredients for making this alleged chemical agent are very, very easy to come by. And so therefore, it's conceivable that anybody with some training, at least anywhere in the world, could have made this, unless we have more evidence. And we haven't got that evidence to pin it on Russia as yet.
You know, Alexander, in reading your article that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, and you elaborated on the case of Litvinenko and the result of the investigation way after the political storm had had its impact here. And they found that they couldn't determine where it came from and a number of issues here. But the storm had already passed, okay? The impression had already been made.
Yeah.
You know, it was Putin did it. Okay, that was they're looking for that moment right now. I surmise probably this is going to happen again, but it'll be far from the public view. It'll be like an appendix in history. Go ahead.
That is the fatal danger of prejudging something before all the facts are there. And that is exactly what happened in the Litvinenko case. The whole assumption at the outset that the Russian state was involved in the Litvinenko case was that polonium was very expensive, was only produced in Russia, and could be traced there. When the inquiry that was convened to look into the Litvinenko case looked at that, and none of it was true. But by that point, as you rightly say, it was far too late, because the idea that the Russians were involved had already become fixed. And there was nothing realistically by that point that was going to change it. And the result was, again, as Annie and Charles have said, lots of other possible lines of inquiry were not followed up.
You know, Annie, one of the things that should be concerning us all is that the different layers of sanctions that the U.S. has put on in the European Union. I mean, there's a separation between the West and Russia further and further apart. And, you know, I surmise that, and I hear this in circles here in Moscow, is that who cares? Why do we want a relationship with these people? They all seem pathological, okay? I mean, it was only a few hours ago, the House Intel Committee came out and said, well, after 18 months, no collusion, okay? And now we get this story in the UK. It's like passing the baton. Let's keep it going. The Russian side is just exhausted by all of this. You're inventing things, lying, exaggerating. The media is so compliant. It's clickbait for them. They don't have to think. They don't have any sense of morality. You know, this is the chasm of trust or lack of trust between the two. And that's worrisome. Go ahead, Annie.
No, I totally agree. I mean, we have a situation where, you know, over the last few years, because of the West's determination not to try and resolve diplomatic issues with Russia, Russia has pivoted towards the East. Yep. You know, all these new trade deals with China, all these new transport lines, pipelines, all the rest of it are huge for Russia and are huge for China. That is not being reported in the West. Alternatively, what you get is someone like me who talks out about this. And I was on RT the night the story broke. 2 hours later, I was on BBC Newsnight the night the story broke. And I said exactly the same points. And yet, on the one hand, I am Putin's useful idiot or a stooge. Yeah. On the other hand, I'm praised for my Newsnight performance. And that duality is actually quite stark when you're living through it. And I think that's what we're seeing at the moment with the Western media. It is dangerous. Mm-hmm. It could exacerbate diplomatic relations between the West and Russia. And, you know, I hope that we can dial down these accusations and come to some sort of diplomatic understanding, proper forensic investigation, and that we can step away from the brink, which is what I think we're beginning to look at.
Yeah, it's very interesting. All of you bring up very rational points and ways to resolve this or try to understand it. But unfortunately, politicians and the media, they don't like it that way. That's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests in London and in Brussels. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.